Welcome to the August podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Charles. The August issue is on the topic of minimally invasive spinal surgery, and the topic editors are Drs. Praveen Mumameni and Adam Kanter. In this podcast, Dr. Mumameni will be speaking with Dr. Paul Park about his approach to minimally invasive transforaminal lumbar interbody fusion with reduction of spondylolisthesis. Dr. Park is an attending in the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Michigan. His research interests include minimally invasive spine surgery and degenerative spinal diseases.
Paul, I read your article on TLIF, and I found it very interesting that you're able to minimally invasively reduce spondylolisthesis. Can you tell me how you guys go about doing that, and you're using some new instrumentation which allows you to retract up on the listhetic level?
Sure. Essentially, I think positioning is important for some of these spondies because just appropriate positioning may help with the reduction. We typically use a Jackson table or perhaps a frame, and with a table we use gel rolls, and it tends to kind of force more of an anatomic alignment to the lumbar spine. And from there,
So you don't like to use an open bottom Jackson table because that would accentuate the lordosis. You prefer to put them on jelly rolls.
Right. That's how all these patients were treated. Since then, I've used some open bottom Jackson frames, and it's worked fairly well either way, I think. But I think just that, you know, I wouldn't use a Wilson frame is my point in terms of positioning the patient. And, you know, at the beginning, I think it helps to do a lot of fluoroscopy because, obviously, you're not seeing much of the anatomy, and particularly with the screw placements and your tubular placements. But how these patients were treated, typically what occurred was, you know, we marked arbitrarily approximately 4.5 centimeters up the midline, parallel lines, and then we started on the symptomatic side. And from there, we utilized a 22-gauge spinal needle. Now, there's a lot of particular aspects of this that I'm not sure are incredibly important, but I'll describe it how the procedure was done for this series. And so the 22-gauge spinal needle was placed sort of in a trajectory you'd want to tube place to give us an idea of where to make the incision. And the goal is to minimize your incision size.
And you're docking that onto the facet joint?
Yes. What you'd ideally want is to dock the tube right on the facet joint with a portion of the lateral lamina on that aspect in view and most of the facet joint, essentially.
And so do you do the facetectomy before you try to reduce the listhesis after you place the screws?
The initial portion, yes, is the complete facetectomy, a good hemilaminectomy, and if there was central stenosis, what we did was wand a tubular retractor contralaterally to undercut the contralateral lamina and facet joint.
Mm-hmm.
So to get a decompression, then we wanted the retractor ipsilaterally. So we did a lot of the work before we even put the screws in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do some of the disc preparation work, but not completely, but some of the initial discectomy, get an intervertebral retractor in. And a lot of times, you know, these patients had a collapsed disc space. We used what we called a rotating osteotome. It really was a right-angled osteotome. The handle was right-angled, and it was an osteotome with a tip. It was pretty small, but what it allowed us to do was enter the disc space, because often it would be very difficult to enter the disc space otherwise. And we did this with fluoroscopic guidance, obviously. We started right where we thought the disc space was, because a lot of times with the spurring and the disc space collapse, there was really, you know, no disc space to enter. And under fluoroscopic guidance, we used the osteotome to enter the disc space. Sometimes it was significantly collapsed, and then once the osteotome was in, we rotated it, and it was able to distract the disc space, at least to the extent that we could get sequential dilators in.
Now, your distraction of your disc space probably would reduce some of your spondylolisthesis. Did that happen in most of the cases?
I would say, yeah, to some degree, distraction helped with the reduction. Not completely, and it varied, but for, I don't know, percentage-wise, but for, I would say the majority, it resulted in some degree of reduction, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And then you use you pulled on the screws in order to complete the reduction with one facet gone, but the contralateral facet still in place.
Correct. And we, you know, I think in the past, the danger is always, you know, with the frame in on the contralateral side, we didn't really decompress it. The concern would be to reduce it and maybe cause a radiculopathy or nerve injury. And we really took great pains to distract the disc space quite a bit to open that frame on the contralateral side. So we were depending on indirect decompression.
Mm-hmm.
So we always had a distractor, you know, we sequentially dilated and left a distractor in place. Then we went to the contralateral side and put the reduction screws in on that side. You know, we'd floor the screws in, and these were translational reducers, sort of like, you know, for an open case, essentially. But they were built into a screw extender, so the caudal screw extender would be set sort of in what was called the reduced position, meaning it would lock the, you know, the polyaxial screw head. It would lock the screw, you know, you put the set screw in, put it in reduced position, and it would lock the rod in place, so that was our anchor point.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the cranial reduction screw extender, we set it to whatever amount of reduction, translational reduction we desired, and we didn't want to over-reduce, so it allowed up to 16 millimeters of offset.
Mm-hmm.
And so typically it wouldn't be 16 millimeters, it'd be like 8 or...
The majority of these cases were grade 1 spondylolisthesis, is
correct.
That right?
Correct, so it wasn't a huge amount.
Mm-hmm.
And it really depended on how much reduction occurred, you know, with after distraction. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, there wasn't a huge amount left to do, but we always try to make it anatomic.
Mm-hmm. Now, with your grade 2 spondylolisthesis, what percent of reduction did you achieve?
I would say the majority, at least grade 1, but at least from my recollection, a few of them all the way, I can remember one where we got a complete reduction, but, you know, I don't have them all.
But on average, you would say you reduced a grade 2 to a grade 1 and a grade 1 to basically nothing.
Correct, on average. And I would have to say, like, for some of the grade 2s, I think we had 8 in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones I was, you know, I was involved in all of them. We had at least a couple we were able to reduce completely. Again, it varied, and it is basically up to the surgeon to decide, you know, how much they're willing to try to reduce it.
Mm-hmm.
But the main goal, obviously, is adequate decompression and good fixation, and it's sort of gravy to get anatomic correction, too.
Sure. And then, you know, the next question that I have for you is, during the reduction, are you watching EMG or doing any kind of monitoring?
You know, for this series, we did not. Now, I am doing that now because I think it's important, not just for that, but it's also for positioning, you know, for the arm positioning as well. So I do it routinely now for every case.
It's interesting to note that you didn't really have a lot of neurological injuries and you didn't use EMG monitoring.
That is true. I think, but it's not a large series. I think for most, and it wasn't like it was a grade 3 spondylolisthesis, so I don't think I would attempt a grade 3. Because obviously, you know, it would be much more difficult with that degree of offset.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it had to do more with the fact that these were, you know, moderate grade at best,
mm-hmm.
and we really, really depended on getting adequate distraction of the disc space and opening that foramen up.
So during the time that you distracted the disc space and you're trying to pull on the cranial screw to reduce the spondylolisthesis, what is in the disc space at that point?
It's a Medtronic device. It's a scissor jack or disc jack.
There's no actual implant in there except for the distraction device, the scissor jack.
Right, correct.
Okay. And so you don't have a temporary dilator in there. You certainly don't have the cage in there while you're trying to do the distraction.
Correct. No, we try to get the reduction done with, just in case there's an issue. You know, we don't want the cage in there just in the disc space during the reduction. No, we just had the our instrument in.
Your series is very nice, and now that you've done all these cases along with Kevin Foley, what would you tell folks who are just starting out with this technique that you wish you knew when you started?
That's a very good question. I think the technique is like anything else. It obviously gets easier the more times you do it. I think the hardest portion of this technique is getting down, you know, the actual, there's a lot of steps to a minimally invasive procedure, and there are a lot of areas that can go wrong, whether it's placing the screws percutaneously or docking it, I think, the tubular retractor correctly and doing your TLIF work. What I would say is, I would do a lot of, if you can, some degenerative disease first before you take on, you tackle any sort of spondylolisthesis, obviously, just so, you know, you could work on your TLIF skills, working through a smaller working channel and placing these screws. Because often with the spondy, placement of the screws can be a little bit more difficult. The sets tend to be more hypertrophic, and, you know, depending on how you place them, it's much more difficult to do. And then when you're actually doing your disc-based distraction or entering your disc space, it can be difficult, particularly with an offset. And the nerves tend to get, you know, the exiting nerve root can be more in your view. So I think for people starting off, I don't think I would start off with a spondylolisthesis case. I would actually, in fact, start off with some just straightforward decompressions using the tube just to get familiar with working inside a smaller space, because it can be disorienting. And I think early on, a lot of fluoroscopy would be useful, whether you do it lateral and AP. I think it's useful because it can be misleading just looking through a small tube and just looking at bone at the bottom, what you're actually doing. So I think, you know, if you could work on your decompressions first and then move on to just sort of maybe straightforward T-lifts prior to doing the spondies would probably be the biggest benefit.
Yeah, and also... For your cases, were there cases where you decided not to do the TLIF and just do a posterior lateral fusion and not make a reduction because the nerve root was in the way?
I would have to say personally, not so much the series that I'm aware of, but for me personally, I've had one particular instance where it was an elderly woman with a grade, essentially barely a grade 2 spondy. Disc space collapsed. The nerve was in the way, and I did back out of it. I just did a posterior lateral. I did more of a mini open in that particular case, mm-hmm. just to see the more of the facet joints and the TP, so I could do a posterior lateral. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think in the end, you need to do I think what you think is best for the patient, and not try to get a good radiographic result. Obviously,
I agree.
So I have backed out of it. So it really depends on, I think, your comfort level with the procedure.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for sharing your concepts and ideas about your spondylolisthesis TLIF minimally invasive techniques. I would encourage our readers to take a look at your article.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
This concludes our podcast for the August issue. Thank you for listening. More details on the procedure described by Dr. Park can be found in his article in this issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the September podcast, when the topic will be Advancements in the Management of Epilepsy. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus, or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to JNS Podcast @thejns.org.